This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Living, I think both of us, if I may say, have lived a kind of a dual heritage at the very least.
Yeah.
And how does that, how do the strains of heritage or so tease upon us throughout our lives, and particularly throughout our creative processes, as with you, you know, photo and literature. And I always sense that in your writing also, with this draw away from the place one is across a distant expanse to the place maybe one came from or feels as though they are meant to be. And so just two or three or four images from my very first work after college. I went back to Kenya, the land where my father was born, and I started to work there. I had been working in a conceptual realm prior, and I began to just make portraits in and around the neighborhood where we lived. And I didn't think they had any merit at the time. I don't know if you think that, but somehow this idea that the thing that comes naturally to you, you often don't quite understand that it can also be effective. You think that the thing that comes more with greater difficulty has more merit.
That's right. You have imposter syndrome where your own business is concerned. But then you have to sort of discover that that is actually what you have to tell the world, because you know, at least as a starting point.
Yeah.
For sure.
So I think this early work for me was part of finding a means by which to learn a visual language, if I may, something that was very consistent with my own sensibilities, my own emotional makeup, and my desire to reach sort of across borders, across boundaries. And just two or three things that I mentioned about these early pictures are, I think, relevant to the later work. In a sense, here in Africa, I was reaching back to heritage, but in particular, this is an image from South Africa, the Boselli School for the Blind. And I graduated from college in the late 80s at the time of the divestment movement in South Africa. And so everybody was speaking about a kind of admonition against traveling to this country. And even then, when I was only in my early 20s, I realized the value of perhaps visiting a place and looking at it with a critical eye, perhaps that had a value that could be added above and beyond what a protest value might be in terms of the notion of a blockade or the notion of clearly turning our gaze away or out of hand condemning.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something we will probably touch upon a little bit later. I think Fazal and I both have the tendency of speaking in dulcet tones to sort of disarm you and think that we're not going to approach difficult things. Maybe later on we'll talk about some of the knots that might be involved in the word boycott.
You know? That's what I would. I mean, that's why I want to share that with you, because there's so few people you can do that who can say, "Well, actually, you know."
You know, because it is certainly complicated. But one of the things that immediately occurs to me is that in this contemporary moment in this country, there are people who have maybe talked about boycott as something that is just objectionable de facto. We don't do boycotts, you know. Not a good idea, we have to engage. Except that loads of people have no problem boycotting Mississippi or North Carolina. It was just this flip just happened and suddenly boycotts are okay. So clearly there's something that needs to be teased out. Why is it unquestionably okay, depending on certain issues? So when you went to South Africa, was it a technical contravention of the boycott?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it was,
but it was past that moment.
It was past that moment, but it was, you know, it was about this idea of
trying to learn from what you're experiencing yourself, trusting your sensibilities, going to a place, perhaps if you're looking at the most salient issues for that country, and trying to find a means by which to speak about it.
That's what I mean. I think a lot of it also comes down to being an artist, being a lone wolf, and trying to figure out what your responsibilities are to the collective priorities. You know, how do we enact the fierce urgency of now as individuals, and how does that interface with the urgency of now as a collective, trying to do a collective action? Rarely is it ever straightforward, actually, even though it's always suits our political purpose to pretend it's straightforward.
As a kind of segue, I mean, the notion of when I was in Kenya, I went back and I worked in the refugee camps then and after South Africa in the early 90s, and I had the opportunity on a Fulbright to be there. And again, you know, the most pressing issue for the country was the refugee crisis in the northern borders. And I thought, oh, this is a chance to look and try and think about how to mitigate or to test our preconceptions of place. And particularly Africa is so freighted with these very heavily laden notions of what those communities mean, that, you know, to invest yourself in being there for a time and to listen and to try in some way broaden, expand upon, and perhaps counter preconceptions that are brought to us by the media or so. I mean, I think you work in a strain of the media in the realm with freedom of the sense of being able to be critical, but in the sense also to give yourself that lone wolf status to take time to listen and to find out how you stand in relation to a certain situation. And for me, the only thing I wanted to say to you directly was that what troubled me, and I was naive about it at the time, was I kept being described as a child of a Kenyan father and American mother. And then they would go on and they'd write some review of the show, and I was,
and
of course...
did you feel as if you were being given a permission that you had not...
It was a kind of legitimacy, you know, and I realized only laterally that this was, in a way, it was almost a kind of racism in the sense that well, the groups that I was photographing in the refugee camps, they were Sudanese, Ethiopian, Rwandan, Somali. I mean, they were different from one another linguistically, tribally, in terms of religion. And so this kind of means by which, and you've written about this means by which we just lump all of these groups together in one cluster. And to me, it was also this sense of, yes, I was proud to, you know, have a Kenyan father, but the truth of the matter, it was even much more complicated than that. My father had emigrated from what was northern India, that later, after partition, turned to Pakistan. So it was a twisted thing.
Your father or his father?
My father's father had emigrated from my grandfather.
Your father was Kenyan. I mean, now that you're talking about it, very, very sort of tangential, but you know, Kenyan father, American mother, you know,
what a mess.
Muslim. I just want to see a long form certificate, you know. I mean, who is he really? You know, and you claim to be American, you know. But
be careful, that's
I mean, is what I want to see.
That's the tenor these days.
But, I mean, part of the complication for you, without a doubt, this further layer is being a Kenyan Asian who recognizes Kenya as a heritage, but you go there and it's majority black country. And there can even sort of be this distancing that happens within Kenya itself of saying, we're Kenyans, they're Indians. Even though Indian Kenyans say, well, we're Kenyan, don't be silly.
I think in a way I learned, not to exactly answer that question, but in a way I think I learned that the specificity of a gaze or of an individual story was something that one could explore that was, in a really broadening sense, was much more expansive than anything I could have imagined about place. So this image in the last one in this African series, I mean, it's an image of Nira Bahira Esteri, and she's holding the two children. She's a midwife. She's holding the two children that she's just helped birth the night before through the night. And they gave their children, like one is Mukanza Bonimpa, which means God will give me, but I do not know when. The names that they give the children, despite what they've endured during the hardships in Rwanda, are full of such hope and grace. And for me, this was like, oh, can one make a body of work that doesn't just dismiss, you know, this hundreds of thousands of Rwandans as callous and having moved through those days of slaughter and genocide, but also allows us living abroad to imagine that there are these layers of complexity, that the society, you know, is jarred, but yet it still is there to somehow provide solace.
And it's so key, and it's actually really difficult to do this kind of portraiture, especially in degrading and very difficult circumstances, that will give you a sense of persons, lives lived, that is not simply a representation of, oh, well, here are these ethnic people, but you actually had these conversations, and therefore there's a sense of... Could you go to the previous one?
Well, I guess I could try and go to the previous one.
Yeah.
I have all the control. No, it's...
yes, you have the power. For me, there is simply something about the way hands are working in this picture that just pushes it over into narrative. And even though you can see their difficulties on their faces, I begin to sense also your intimacy with that space already. It's very hard to do. John Berger talks about August Sander's portraits and about why do they have that look on their face? What did Sander say to each of them that gave them this collected, connected presence in what, after all, were typological portraits? It's terribly hard, but it doesn't surprise me to know that you know their names, you know their stories, because that it had to be grounded in that.
Well, and I think the best thing actually you can do is to strip away your ego and to kind of allow for the space wherein people will do the things that come to them naturally. I mean, I would say this is one of the my favorite pictures that I've ever made, and I didn't realize it as such at the time, but it had to do with the notion of three women, the girl recovering from malaria, Athok Doom, and the mother is in the middle and the aunt is on the left. They choose, the first time they're ever represented in a photograph, to show they're caring for this daughter. And it's their configuration. And what I realized very soon was that anything you imagine as being an effective image and try to construct, there's a subtle way in which you see that, or it unravels over time. The strongest images are about those, not in the sense of my images, but are those that when you go back to them, each time you invest yourself in looking at them, they have a resonance which just strengthens the relationship between viewer and image.
I mean, absolutely, because the one thing that, I mean, you could have seen the hand at the back, of course, that triangle formed by those arms, but perhaps you didn't see that other hand holding that arm at the time you took the photo. That might have been one detail too many, but it's one of the things that just sort of completes it, almost makes it feel like, you know, those paintings of Mary visiting Elizabeth, the Renaissance paintings, where there's this moment of sororal solicitude where they touch each other, and that's the only sense that is inevitably reflexive. To touch someone is also to be touched.
Mm.
It cannot go just one way.
Mm.
And so when we look at things like that, immediately we feel that kind of tenderness. So it's a powerful picture.
I think in a way that's... We better move forward. But I think in a way that's the kind of thing that really instructed being in Israel, is this... When I was given this invitation, if I may just describe the project. I mean, it was a very generous invitation, but at the same time, it was one that filled me with trepidation, both in terms of whether or not I would find something that would strike a chord, be resonant with my own work, And also, of course, concerned about the notion of being instrumentalized. You know, somebody with my face, with my name.
In 2010.
2010, yeah.
You get an invitation to come shoot in Israel-Palestine as part of a group of photographers, internationally renowned photographers, who I asked to independently do their work responding to the terrain.
Yep. And one of the main questions was, firstly, do you have complete freedom to investigate what interests you? And and you had great time, and I had the opportunity then to see a place which I never would otherwise have had such an entree. So I went, and I think I made two or three trips before I agreed that, in fact, I could participate. Because you also don't want to take such a generous commission and not come up with the goods in the end. You know, you don't want to use that and just create something really simple. So the first step to the piece, which is here at the museum, Desert Bloom, was actually, it's three projects that are really strongly interconnected. Yeah, and they move organically from one to the next. The first one was about interviewing combatants on both sides of the divide, Israelis and Arabs, who had lived together prior to the war and who latterly spoke about the battles and about this rift in the society. And this was something I thought was really fascinating. One of the main gifts of the project was we were all from without. We were all outsiders, which one would say, in one sense, that was an easy way to cast aside our perspectives, but it also allowed us the opportunity to move, in my case, seamlessly between one community and another in a fashion which would not have been possible for either an Israeli or a Palestinian. And so my first kind of mode of investigating was after hearing an Israeli combatant, former combatant, now in his 70s, talking about his fighting in Latrun. And then kind of grew interested in trying to find some of these sites, not only of the battles, but of the villages that had been evacuated in the course of those battles. You know, the notion that Israel was a land without a people for a people without a land. It was barren. It was an empty space to which the community could begin in a country. Yeah. And for me, this idea that there was this latent history subsumed within the land, and in a way I realized very quickly, somehow a taboo subject, subtly, that bringing up the events of 48 and what had happened in those villages seemed to be a very unseemly gesture.
So taboo in what
broadly within the Israeli context, it's not an easy subject. And it seemed to me one could really only take a commission like that if you were prepared to be open and to look at these difficult issues the same way in which perhaps I had in South Africa or in the refugee camps, to kind of go through vulnerability, to listen, and to try and decipher for yourself the clues and how you stand in relation to those kinds of voices, images, places, right?
Did you, at the beginning, so there's this money, there's this freedom, there's probably the considerable pressure of knowing that among the other people who were invited were extraordinary photographers like Kudelka, Stephen Shore, Gilles Perez also. No?
Wendy Ewald.
Wendy Ewald.
Jeff Ewald.
So there's sort of that sense in your head that must have been attractive to be part of this group.
That's not particularly attractive. That's rather intimidating, actually. But I understand the idea.
Attractive is just another word I use for intimidating. But maybe that's me.
Well, but it makes you realize how important it is to figure out, to take the time to figure out if you can contribute something that's true to your own sense of making, your own, like I said, the trajectory of your own work. Otherwise, it serves no purpose if you're going to go to a place just to make something to serve the project. It has to move you forward.
Let us also not assume, because this is a really sophisticated and savvy and strongly opinionated Brooklyn audience, so we shall not assume excessive innocence on their part. One of the questions that I would sort of ask right away is, you go there, you start thinking about villages destroyed in 48 or 67. Why? What business of yours is it? Okay, let me play devil's advocate and say, okay, villages were destroyed. But that's not the only place in the world where villages are destroyed. Why this sustained interest in a country that is not your own, on a subject that is very touchy for the people who are directly involved or who might be implicated? In other words, how do you defend yourself against a charge of being of selective outrage in a world of outrages to choose from?
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of supposition that's often leveled about people who come to Israel. You know, the notion of, well, you come from America, why didn't you look at the Native Americans? I think that, firstly, I mean, one does not have a different value than another. I think that if you look at communities in a kind of considered way, and you give yourself to them in the way in which is consistent with your own voice and priorities, and honestly, openly, I think that has whatever value it will have in the world. And I like the notion of permission. I don't think you need to be, I think in fact it's divisive to say that you need to be from a place to have the right to speak about that place. Did Robert Frank, he wasn't American, he probably made the most extraordinary work ever made about America. I mean, that's an obvious one.
To push the question a little bit further, somebody might say, yeah, but we don't have so many people thinking about, you know, let's say what Turkey is doing to Kurdish people or to minorities within Turkey.
For me, this was like the most complicated puzzle to unravel. I mean, my work has always been, firstly, it was about heritage, my own heritage, my relationship to Africa, and then following on from that, my relationship to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and looking for the sort of rail of continuity left me by the legacy of my grandfather. And so when you learn this kind of investigation, meeting people on a human level, looking at things over an extended period, I think that for me it's natural to apply that same sort of overlay or that same sort of mode to wherever I am. And so I think that people bristle at the idea that one would do that in Israel because it is such a difficult place in which to work. And there's so much at stake there, right? Mm-hmm. The Old and New Testaments, the notion that you need the right credentials. And what does that mean, the right credentials?
Yeah, well, I certainly reject that idea of right credentials. It's more about being there, open-minded, willing to learn.
And listening to the individual. I mean, I think that goes, if one listens to the individual anywhere in the world, you're able to make a connection that goes, pierces to the heart of the matter and moves beyond all sorts of borders, moves beyond national borders, gender borders, religious borders. You're listening and you're looking at an individual.
Yeah.
And so for me, that was like, you had to figure out your own relationship to 48 in me personally until I could move forward.
Sure.
So it was like a training manual. It was like I'd read a great deal about what happened, but eventually I actually realized that I could only move forward if I trusted my own sensibilities about the place. He's looking suspicious down there.
I'm asking you these questions because I need answers.
That's
to that.
The.
All right. So I want to. We want to show you. The pictures are extraordinary. It's a complicated project. What we have on display here is a section of it called Desert Bloom. Well, it's a complicated project that has three parts.
This is Memory Trace, actually.
What?
This is the Memory Trace.
What we have on display.
Oh, in the museum.
I know.
Yeah.
Three parts. There's a section of portraits that we'll see in the end. It's called Nakba, Catastrophe. And what Fazl has done is that he has portraits since the year 1948 to the present, How many years is that?
Until well, at the time it was 65 years, 2013. Yeah.
2013, a 65-year span. One person, Israeli-Palestinian, or I should say Israeli-Palestinian Arab, or Israeli-Arab, whatever. Some kind of complicated rhythm. I'm no musician, I can't count. For each year, each of those 65 years, so you have a portrait of 65 portraits of human beings. That was the concept of Nakba. People who had been shaped, in other words, portraits of an aftermath, really, was one volume. A second volume was Memory Trace, which at ground level did pictures of persons, places, stones, seemingly innocuous landscapes, and a kind of very deep research into how all of that came to be. And Memory Trace had a lot to do with those villages that were, and towns, that were destroyed, erased, emptied out, taken over, renamed, all the sorts of things that when they're described to you, you sort of think, well, that actually didn't happen because that's absurd and cruel, but they actually did happen. That's how a lot of the territory was taken. And so that volume dealt with that. And then the third, which is what's on display here, called Desert Bloom, focuses mostly on the Negev, the desert region, in a very interesting and intricate way. That actually lays out the complication of saying desert and pretending we know what we mean. But this is a political, climatological, geographical, agricultural level of complications and definitions. And to make that visible, Fazel went up in planes and took these incredibly detailed aerial photos of the Negev. And the core of that project goes back to something that David Ben-Gurion said in the 1930s, that one of the key necessities of Zionism was, the British had set the northern border of the country and said, well, you guys are not going beyond that, Was it set up at the Golan Heights, pretty much? Yeah. And well, south is a desert. You can't use that. But then you think, maybe we can. With science, with just pluckiness, we will make the desert bloom. We will build forests there. We will make it habitable. We will irrigate. We'll use it for agriculture. Except that there are people in the desert as well. And so, he's looking at me like I'm a madman right now.
<Can we? laughs>
Would you like to jump in at some point before I wreck myself?
There's a very kind of clear and fluid relationship between this memory trace, which we've just sort of gone through, and Desert Bloom. And they were, as I said, organic. So when you talk about looking at 48, I didn't really know that these three pieces would come out of that. And so I had to start somewhere like a novice. I had to look at what people would say was maybe a very basic, essential thing that was close to me. And
which was interviews.
Yeah, in doing that, actually, in what you've just seen, were these images of the landscape and also of the landscape of the face of those who were rendered. Many of the people passed away in the time since I'd photographed them, but they offer you stories that allow you to be a kind of conduit. You can go to the place that they haven't been for 65 years, visit their village, and then travel across either into the Arab-Israeli villages or across the checkpoints into the West Bank, and meet those people. So it's a very odd position in which to be as an artist, photographer, writer, whatever.
Or just as a human being, right? It, whatever else might be going on, you actually encounter a very powerful sense of unfairness. I had somebody in Bethlehem say to me, well, you know, she was an elderly lady, a Christian, and somewhat well-to-do, and you know, she played piano in her house and all. And she said, I have not been to Jerusalem since 1967, and I miss it so much. And you're going to go tomorrow. And indeed I was. Yeah,
that's quite a burden to bear.
Well, it's just strange, right? Mm-hmm. Because I could see who I was talking to, and I was like, why would somebody keep you from going to the place where you grew up? And somebody else said to me, I grew up next to the sea, and I'll never see it again until I die.
There's something about the notion for us as listeners just of taking a kind of testimony, the notion of what that is in the relationship to in relation to the person, you know, this idea of catharsis. Somebody had written recently that actually one of the testimonies was made up. So to imagine that somebody, in this case, it was a person who had endured, lived through a terrible massacre, and had never had anybody take his story in all of those 65 years. And yet, finally his story is recorded, and the supposition is that actually it was faked, it was concocted. So even to refuse the notion of that kind of catharsis is amazing to me and heartbreaking. So I want to give you the kind of connection between the memory trace and finally to the desert is many of these sites in the corridor, particularly between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, had been planted over in the time after the founding of the state. And so one would look within these forests, these nature reserves, for the remnants of the old villages, and often there was nothing left. They'd been completely subsumed beneath these conifers that would kill the natural gardens of the prior villages. And so,
and that had a double intent, right? One was actually literally to erase, but the other was a kind of... Could you go back to the previous one just a second?
Could, certainly.
Oh, yeah. but the other point, one was political in order to erase, but part of the pretext was also, or not the pretext, but the apologia for what was going on, was environmental, was that we need to retain topsoil, we need to build, it's an arid country, we need trees. So afforestation was... in part, an environmental concern and intervention, right? It was framed.
Yeah, that's a complicated and multi-layered question, but that perhaps that was one of the modes, but it was also a good means by which to alter the landscape and to acquire the landscape in a more palatable fashion.
That's
and this is the thing, actually, which is the link, in a way, to the Desert Bloom series, and there's one picture in particular which taught me about looking at the desert, and it's this one up here. It's the village of Al-Araqib as seen from above. And I had a meeting one day with the Bedouin elders in this community that only weeks before had been the site of the village. And what one sees, it's a horrible rendering, but there are these small shacks. There are sort of small shacks in the sort of scarified landscape above this rectangle at center. The rectangle itself is actually the perimeter of the cemetery. And when the village which had surrounded the cemetery was razed to the ground, the villagers immediately set about building these protest tents just outside in the space where their village had once been. And on a near daily basis, the IDF was coming and raising them again to the ground, though they were just shacks at the time. And when this Sheikh Sayah was telling me about what this expanse of land that I was looking at had once been only a few weeks prior, it seemed to me essential to see what that meant in context. What did that space look like from above?
Yes.
I didn't know what it would lead to, but I knew it was important somehow to begin to grasp what was happening in the desert and to begin to think about what this invocation from Ben-Gurion and before to make the desert bloom, what that had done to the desert in the years, the intervening years from the time of the founding of the state until today.
I mean, there's so much. Please, back to that one and just hold thought. In one image of this kind, I mean, part of what excites me about the work is that if you look at an exhibition of these or you look at the book, the first impression is of a kind of either just abstract beauty. It's patterning, right? The earth from the air, it's so beautiful. It could almost be like an abstract painting. And some of them are even more abstract than this. One very much gets that sense while going through that landscape that there is a lot of muted color and then there's patterning, right, which is appealing to the eye. But the second thing you think about, obviously, is Google Maps. This is not an image that necessarily announces itself as having been made by a person in a plane. Maybe the tilt a little bit, but even with Apple Maps now, you look at terrain, it is reminding us of images made by machines in a quite dispassionate way. Mm-hmm. And what those two impressions can do is that they can kind of cut off the image because the earth is big. If it's just Google Maps, or if it's just abstract, you enjoy it for patterning. But what I discovered as I went through your work is that each one of these, each line, each trough, each area of dark color is something. It means something. The landscape has no random features, just the way that a face does not have random features. And we know that cheeks are here, and we know that that's a forehead. So if you look at something like this, for example, you talked about the cemetery in the middle over there. Obviously, those are roads.
So if you begin to learn, I mean, that you touch upon a few things here. I mean, basically, one has to begin to learn to interpret what the land is offering you. And for me, that was a long learning process because I wanted to be above the land without any preconception of what I was receiving, what I was responding to, right? And then slowly, as I was flying again and again, I started to understand the signifiers. I started to see what was afforestation. So for instance, this piece here is the outskirts of Al-Araqib. It's an area, you can see there's a bulldozer in the right quadrant. Each of these little incisions in the land is a trough into which four or five seedlings are placed. So essentially the village is raised, and then the space is recontoured, and the architecture of the forest that will be there in the next 20 years, or in 20 years, is begun. And so you slowly realize when you're above the land what these little signifiers are showing you. And I think what two other things you touch upon is, one is, can one make an aesthetic image? What value does that have? Is there propriety in that? And for me, the interesting thing is, if an image is able to woo us, able to convince us to engage with it, and then we read what actually is held within that image, because many of these are jarring in the sense that your first encounter with them, you don't really know what it is you're responding to. And then often when you read what actually is there, there's this kind of rupture between your first initial sense of space and your newly informed sense of space. And Google Maps is also part of that, or Google Earth, in the sense that all of the coordinates for the spaces in the exhibition that are there offer even any viewer to go to Google Earth, put in those coordinates, and then you can see what has happened. Yeah, you can see in the timeline what has happened in this space in the last 10 years. And for me, that's fascinating. The image is but a moment's pause along this continuum. And 20 years from now, you can look back those whatever 30 years, and you'll see this image housed there, right? Yeah. And for me, it's an investment in that continuum.
I mean, it's almost as if you provided a punctum from the outside by giving us two bits of information. The bulldozer, which I had not noticed, it's right there. And that's amazing. It just immediately provides scale. And then secondly, the information that this is on land that was somebody's home. Could you talk a little bit about what made the situation of the Bedouins? Well, there are two things. What made the situations of the Bedouins so precarious?
I think we'll be talking quickly if I get a gentle.
Specifically, you know, people who are living in the Negev in particular, their situation is a little bit different from people in the West Bank and Gaza. What kind of legal arguments is the state of Israel making vis-a-vis their presence in the land? And then secondly, we can talk about ISOHEDS.
I think we probably don't have too much time. I don't know if we... 10 minutes? Okay. Sorry, that was rather brutal. Maybe you could put it down a slight bit again if you don't mind. Sorry. Well, what I quickly learned about Al-Araqib, which has since been raised to the ground more than 90 times, with villagers that
in
had...
In other words, they keep going back.
They keep building, then they raise
and
it again.
They show up in the middle of the night and raise it.
So, for instance, here, this is the ambassador forest. The notion that ambassadors from all over the world were asked to take seedlings and plant them on this land. The South African ambassador, in fact, was the only one who refused because he said that he had lived through apartheid and he wasn't prepared to plant atop an area that was still... in a controversial space in which there were still claims for land. The state will say that they prefer that the Bedouin gain the infrastructure of being in settled townships. This is a separate debatable question which I think is beyond the scope of our conversation. But for me, I'm much more interested in seeing the layers of history. It wasn't only the Bedouin that were being marginalized by these changes. It was also about a kind of attitude towards the land. I'm just going to skip very quickly through these, if you don't mind, since we only have a few moments. So these, you know, you don't know when you first fly over them what they are, and latterly you realize, oh, these are things called sir, which are the corral. Exactly,
corral,
it was the corral
and the sheep and goats and cows.
Exactly, so it was that would have been a fertilized area, and each year the Bedouin would burn the corral from the last year. So this shows you, at the very least, 3 or 4 years of the Bedouin having moved through this space in the
and
terrain.
This is so important because one of the arguments against the Bedouin is that, well, they never settled anyway, so they're not really on the land.
But this
now
is,
you know that they have.
And this is an interesting notion. I mean, I think it also touches upon different attitudes towards how one should inhabit the land, right? If you live, and I'm just going to search for a Bedouin. There's a perfect example. So these are the seer you've seen in that earlier picture in the midst of one of the villages of the Abu Asfa family in an unrecognized village. So it is at risk of being razed and the villagers moved out. And what one sees from a Western perspective is that this haphazard manner in which they're living seems out of keeping with a sophisticated life. But what I sort of learned over time was maybe that this was also symptomatic of different attitudes towards what the land is. So the Bedouin, they live in a way in a very inhospitable land, but they live in a kind of fragile balance there, right? They move when the climate is too fierce to another area that's more hospitable, and they come back in the cycle of the year when it's, you know, suitable to be there, maybe to plant for a short time. Whereby the state, what one sees in the machinations of the state often are this would be a PETA military installation to mimic installations across the borders of what could be nations that they might fight with.
The state tends towards permanence, find a fixed use for it.
Well, or to, this is now the outskirts of what will be the sprawl of a new settlement. So it has to do with the notion of asking or trying to encourage the land to conform what we would like it to be as compared to modifying our expectations and scaling ourselves down to what the land offers us. And this was, for me, the most interesting thing to experience. And to see at the same time not just the notion of the Bedouin, but also what one can see from that God's eye perspective is layers of history that one can't see on the ground. So this is Rehovot in the Negev, right? A Nabataean village where you can see the main thoroughfare to the square at left and the perimeter of the village all around. When you're on the ground, you don't see that. You just see ripples. Exactly.
And that's all you see. And this was a notable, was it a Bronze Age?
This is the Rehovot in the Negev. Yeah, it's a famous archaeological site.
I'm sure people are curious about, I mean, just this experience. You're going up in Glen, you went up dozens of times, right?
I went up about 12 or 14 times, yeah.
Okay. So about 12 or 14 times in a plane, in the desert, in a heavily militarized area. I mean, the desert might be sparsely populated, but the air is like crazy, right? Because mm-hmm. there's military jets, there's commercial flights, there's all kinds of things going on. And your plane is at the lowest level of that.
Thanks, yeah.
Right?
Lowest level in all sorts
in
of
all
ways.
Kinds
yeah,
of
that's,
ways.
That's the way I existed in that region mostly.
I'm just saying it sounds lowest like level. A great time. Somebody who looks like you in a plane, in like a militarily, you know, restricted area in the south of Israel.
There was a lot of
with the door
luck.
Open.
There was a lot of next to a military pilot with a door off the
Fantastic.
Plane, so you don't want to offend anybody. But there was great luck in that because we were able to see things. I think by virtue of the fact that we had a good rapport, we developed a good rapport.
It had to be a military pilot.
Most of the pilots had some strong military experience in the past, at least. He was more of an environmentalist in the end, but
and you were strapped to your chair.
Yeah, it was sort of like this, but without the arms and a seatbelt.
And the door was open.
Yeah, and they tilt it nicely when you want to get a good picture.
Not that I have a fear of, I have a fear of heights. No, not at all. I have a fear of death.
Curiously, I had no idea what that would feel like. I thought I'd be sick or absolutely terrified, which I will admit I was on some occasions. But what was
you're so fascinated?
You get
I'm
so
not like that, so.
Yeah. It's so
that's
intoxicating,
yeah.
Looking and receiving what it's like. Everything is a gift to you. You're not like in a portrait, creating an atmosphere. You're actually responding to the gift of what you're being shown. And for me, this was just an extraordinary thing, and also not something I could have imagined. It was only after making the images and beginning to understand what the land was holding that I could start to research those spaces and start to understand what I was looking at each time.
And there's a wonderful fourth volume that accompanies those three volumes that of photographs called The Conflict Shoreline, written by A.L. Weitzman. Densely researched but gorgeously written account of precisely what we mean by the desert and what is going on there in terms of millimeters of rain per annum, less than 200 millimeters of rain per annum, and everything beyond that, and this band of dryness that just sort of extends over 7,500 kilometers across the earth, you know, going all the way from really from Morocco all the way to past India, this band where things start to get dry. And how those places are often the places where there are conflicts, you know, breakaway regions of nations. Those are the places where people are getting killed by drones, just all the way across like that. Unfortunately,
yes, I think we
are running short of time. I want to ask you one last thing, which is what do you want this work to do out in the world?
That's actually the best question for the end. I think that our role as makers is not to propose a neatly packaged solution, but to hopefully offer an invitation to people to want to somehow experience the level of confusion and complexity that we have felt while being there, to allude to the layers, the depth of the place, to the issues.
Can I push you a bit and also suggest that this then involves taking sides?
You know, when I was first visiting, an academic there said, you know, he said to me, you know, you have to take sides. You have to take a side, excuse me. And I so bristled at that notion because that's so against my own sensibilities. You know, what I received in Israel and the West Bank was actually incredible hospitality on both sides of the divide, almost on a daily basis. So there's incredibly jarring that you could visit, I'm just going to run right to a section I'd like to show you at the very last. You could visit an Israeli family at one moment and kind of receive an hospitality that I had never received before, and the next day go across a checkpoint and meet with a Palestinian family who offered you the same generosity. And you know that those two would... Well, the checkpoint was never a very pleasant moment for me, that's true. So... But the idea, I think that's really important for me, is this idea of, I think when you see the three volumes, you have the sense of some levels that need to be attended to. I think that it is proper to look at the legacy of 48 and to acknowledge a great level of aggression as a means by which to move forward in a productive fashion. I mean, I think both sides deserve the right to have their own pain acknowledged fully and freely and openly, right? And not to deny or obfuscate. And for me, that was my first desire, was to work on both sides and to create something that could be open to both sides, showing empathy through an individual that makes the viewer then also confounded by this idea. It's not just, oh, Israelis are great, Palestinians are evil, or vice versa. It's somehow the chance to meet both communities in an open way, but also acknowledge, I mean, you will see in those books an insistence upon facts of history. And that I really find troubling, the desire on either side to deny a history of the other, right? And so the last piece I made is just, I finally, in the end, I felt like I had maybe found a means by which to articulate that expanse of time between 48 and today, but also to connect very intimately to members of both communities at the same moment, and to acknowledge something that I realized in those 4 years, which was a kind of a scar or wound that was laced throughout both societies, even if for young people who were not directly involved in things. And this was, for me, kind of amazing.
And this is that Nakba.
This is Independence Nakba. It's the notion that every spring comes Independence Day for Israel, and that same time of the year is Nakba Day, the day of the catastrophe for the Palestinians. How could these two so inextricably linked communities and moments in time move forward?
Was this and it's sort of like, you know, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old,
very basic. Yeah.
And is it always the Israeli on the left and the Palestinian on the right, or did you?
You could tell me.
I should tell you.
Anyway. There are different modes of that piece, but yes, it's always consistent, but it's not stated. And so
I ask because I don't see color, so
the idea is that, like, you only sometimes it's only the signifier of the clothing, right, that allows you to see the difference. Or sometimes what also interests me was the idea that you could feel a degree of empathy for one side in one diptych, and yet two diptychs later for the other side. How is that possible? When you read about it, or you're a member of either of those communities, how can you feel empathy towards the other?